Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of our program today, we'll be talking about manufacturing in the United States, its importance to the American economy, and what's been happening with manufacturing and manufacturing jobs over the last decade or so. Certainly, we know that manufacturing is important to the economy of the country. It's also important to the economy of the state of Illinois. It's the number one contributor to the state's economy. However, at the same time, we can also say that in the period between 2000 and 2007, the state of Illinois has lost more than 196,000 manufacturing jobs. So the question we'll try to take up this morning is just why is it that this has happened? What it means for the nation and for the Midwest, and ask the question, is there something that we can do as a nation to try to rebuild American manufacturing and recapture some of the jobs that have been lost? And we have two guests with us, joining us, both of them by telephone this morning. Scott Paul is the founding executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. This was launched in April of 2007 to do research and advocacy about domestic trade laws and particularly the issue of competition between the United States and other countries. Before forming the Alliance, he was the principal lobbyist for the Industrial Union Council. He was a trade lobbyist at the AFL-CIO, where he led the labor movement's legislative initiatives on international trade, manufacturing, and foreign policy issues. Also joining us is Ken Goldstein. He is an economist at the Conference Board and has been since 1971, interested in looking at things like labor market activity and economic development. For the past three decades, he's been writing about the state of the economy in Conference Board publications such as the Conference Board Review, Business Cycle Indicators, and Straight Talk, and he has given a lot of economic presentations to groups around the U.S. and also in Canada. And as we talk, questions are welcome. We ask people who are listening, please, if you can, keep your comments and questions brief so we can move along here and get in as many callers as we can. But certainly people who are listening are welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're interested in giving us a call and being a part of the conversation, you're welcome to do that. Well, Mr. Paul, hello.
Good morning.
And Mr. Goldstein, hello.
Good morning from New York.
Thank you both very much for talking with us. Just as a way of starting, those numbers that I quoted, that the number about lost manufacturing jobs comes from your, Mr. Paul, from your website, and you have here a map of the United States. And what you can do is you can click on your state and these numbers will come up. And if you just click around the Midwest, you can see the picture is similar to that in Illinois. Over in Indiana, almost 110,000 jobs lost, manufacturing jobs lost over that period of time. In Missouri, looking at 70,000. In Iowa, almost 21,000. In Wisconsin, close to 99,000. That's a lot of jobs. If I spent the time to click all the way across the country and looked at every state here, has everyone lost manufacturing jobs?
There are a couple of exceptions, like North Dakota and Nevada, which have a small manufacturing base to begin with. But you're right to point out the trend. Since 2000, about one out of every five manufacturing jobs across the country has disappeared. And that's a total today of about 3.7, 3.8 million jobs. And the news is not terrific this year as well. I mean, there are a lot of sectors of the economy that are losing jobs, but the job losses monthly in manufacturing continue to mount.
Mm-hmm. And let me turn to Mr. Goldstein, and I obviously we want the focus here to be of the United States, but I guess I'm curious, if you look at other in major industrial countries, would you see the same kind of thing?
You would see almost exactly the same kind of thing. And this didn't start in 2000. This has been going on for a long time. I actually come from a small town in northern New Jersey. And my old man and the other fathers down the block, these folks were working in companies like General Electric, General Dynamic, Esso. All of those firms, are long since gone. So that all of the sons of those fathers as well as certainly all the daughters, have gone work in other sectors, because that manufacturing base has really been shrinking, not for the last decade, but for the last half century.
And these jobs, is it the case that they simply vanished, or is it that they left the United States but went someplace else, and now someone else is doing them, but they're doing them in Asia, could be in Latin America, just not in the United States.
And I think the example is the General Motors plant on Route 109 in Linden, New Jersey, that just closed in the last 18 months. I mean, there was somebody working at that plant for a long time, holding a rivet gun and putting a rivet in a hunk of metal and doing exactly that same function over and over and over again, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year. Nobody in America today does that kind of a job. Either a machine does it, or, as you just said, we've sent that job somewhere else.
Let me ask this question, and I'll ask Mr. Goldstein first, because I would expect Mr. Paul would have I think I know what he would say. But if we set aside the fact that this is a loss of a job for an American, and that's bad for them, I don't want to minimize that. But if you then ask the question, well, as far as the economy is concerned, does it matter that we have lost these jobs?
This is exactly why I wanted to put it in that kind of historical perspective. You know, we don't have people who are doing those kinds of functions today. On the other hand, I have not one. I have two nephews who get paid to play video games. They say, no, Uncle Kenny, we're testing software. That's the difference in some sense in terms of what people are doing today, what kids are doing today, as opposed to what their fathers or grandfathers were doing 50 years ago. One last point here. George Meany, the old head of the AFL-CIO, said more than half a century ago, companies that don't make money are companies that don't have money to hire folks. So part of the impetus as to why this has been going on so widespread and for so long is precisely from that function.
Well, let me ask Scott Paul, because I think that some people would say what we're seeing here is an historic shift in the economy and in terms of what it is that people do and where the economic base is. And some people have said, well, it's just we have shifted away from manufacturing. People do other kinds of things to make their living, and that's just a trend we're going to have to learn to live with.
I think it's a mistaken perception, because you have to have both. And you need a thriving manufacturing base to support a service economy. Manufacturing jobs have a multiplier effect that no other economic activity in the United States has. They support four or five other jobs. And in the case of high-value aerospace or auto jobs, they support seven or eight other jobs. The fact is that in the 1990s, we were gaining manufacturing jobs in all but 2 years. Globally, in China, they've gained 6 million manufacturing jobs from 2002 to 2005. So there is a shift occurring here. And it's not necessarily because it's not products we're not using anymore, like buggy whips, or increased productivity and technology doesn't explain all of these job losses. We have a massive trade debt. And because of import competition and shifts of production, we have seen a substantial decline in the manufacturing base. And I'm not going to make the argument that trade or these production shifts are the cost are causing all of these job losses, but certainly much more than many folks are willing to give credit for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to have you both address it. It spends more time addressing the why question, why it is that we have lost, why manufacturing has left the United States, and why we have lost these jobs. And I suppose trade policy may well be one of the factors. Let me stay with Mr. Paul. Other than that, and I'm sure we can talk some more about that, what would you think would be the major reasons for the trend that we've seen?
I think that there are three or four key factors that are contributing to this manufacturing job loss. And obviously trade is one of those. And I'm not including, you know, the fact that we trade in particular, but more specifically, some trade practices, some subsidies that other countries are providing, the exchange rate of different currencies, and the lack of enforcement of the trade agreements that we have in place beyond that, there are a couple of structural issues that make it very difficult for manufacturing to be competitive in this country. Chief among those, I think, is healthcare costs. It is, I think, widely known that $1,800 a car for the General Motors makes in the United States, $1,800 of the price they sell that car for comes out right away to pay for the health care expenses for their active workers and their retirees, and that's not a burden that car makers in Canada or in Asia or in Europe face, and it's a tremendous burden on our domestic manufacturers, and so having a presidential-level discussion about health care is very important. Energy costs in the United States obviously have an impact on the competitiveness of manufacturing, and our tax code does as well. We have a number of incentives in the tax code that make sourcing from abroad more attractive and don't necessarily encourage domestic sourcing. And if we were to take a broad-based approach and look at some of these issues, we could repair some of the structural damage that has been done to the manufacturing base.
Well, let me turn to Mr. Goldstein. Anything that you might want to add to that list, or do you want to elaborate on or add anything to any of those points?
I think I want to make two points. One, the debate about what to do and how to pay the health bill for the American worker in general, that's a separate debate. But I think we need to broaden the discussion a little bit in terms of the fact that it's not just the United States that is sending jobs abroad. The United States is sending jobs south. Europe is sending jobs east. Asia is sending jobs west into Cambodia and to Vietnam and so forth, thriving those specific economies. So, I mean, it's not specific to the United States. It's not specific to medical care. What it is about is a long-term process that's been going on for a long time. And it's about not just the loss of a manufacturing job, but also whether or not we can replace that job and keep the workforce employed. Look, we had, until we got into the latest difficulties, we had a below 5% unemployment rate in the United States. Once we get past the current crisis, and we will get past the current crisis, it's only a question of whether it's going to take another year or another 18 months. But when we get past this, we're going to have an economy in the United States growing at 3, maybe even 3.5%. And that implies that total employment will be rising by 1% a year, perhaps for a decade, maybe even two decades. The population is growing more slowly than that. And so I can tell you, both from our analysis here at the conference board, as well as talking to executives, their big issue in terms of what the employers are talking about, not just for the next year, but the next decade, is not where the job's going to be tomorrow for America, but where are the people?
We have a caller here. I want to get him into the conversation, but for anybody who has just joined us, we want to introduce again the guests. And the last person you heard is Ken Goldstein. He's an economist with the Conference Board and has worked there since 1971, analyzing current trends in labor market activity and also working on forecasting economic development. Our other guest is Scott Paul. He's the founding executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, and he's somebody who has been working in this area also for a long time, too. Before forming the alliance, he was the principal lobbyist for the Industrial Union Council. He was also a trade lobbyist at the AFL-CIO. We're talking about manufacturing, American manufacturing, the place that it plays in the economy, what's happening with manufacturing jobs, and also one of the questions we want to try to ask is it possible for America to revitalize manufacturing and try to recapture some of the jobs that have been lost over the last decade or so? Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Something I'm interested in, and I know there's going to be a lot of things discussed here, is something that I've noticed just as a trend of maybe reading history and like when I grew up, you know, I was looking for my first real job in the late 70s, which was kind of exciting because the economy was going through a transition. In my perspective, one of the issues that I see amongst this plethora of issues is that there's a lack of what I would call to be capitalization, maybe, investment in actual manufacturing goods and hard property that is used to create products. And I say that not to knock corporate businesses or the current model, because that's a whole other issue, but just to say, you know, in the 60s and 70s in the United States, there were a lot of factories that had been constructed in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And in particular, say, in the steelwork, there was not a whole lot of what I would call recapitalization or new investment in hard property to enter the next generation. And I'm not trying to blame anybody, but I see this as a continuing trend in the U.S., is that there seems to be a reluctance to do what happened in the late 1800s, where there is this incredible risk-taking, an incredible investment in hard capital and more hard capital. And I'm just curious how you folks feel about that leading to the loss of manufacturing. And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. Well, maybe Mr. Goldson, you want to go first?
Yeah, I would say this, that certainly those old 100-year-old steel mills in the Pittsburgh area that were shut down in the early 1980s after running for 100 years, they could have been revitalized. They could have spent a lot of money changing. But even if they did, there was an understanding that that kind of mass-produced steel just simply couldn't be produced in the United States at prices competitive with steel coming from elsewhere. And that's part of the reason why almost three decades ago, we had what we called the shutdown of Smokestack America. But that doesn't mean that steel ended production in the United States altogether. In fact, sleepy old Mobile, Alabama, it always was the southern Pittsburgh. It's even more so today with a thriving steel industry, not producing mass production steel, but specialized steel for specific products. That's one answer. Second answer, I can tell you I was recently in Wyoming, a very small state, but a state that's energy dependent and looking to diversify its economy. And I'll tell you, one of the things they told me is that they're sending representatives into Illinois to try to convince employers to relocate to Wyoming because they have more resources, more land, and so forth. So it is not the case that across the board there's been a decapitalization of industry, of manufacturing. It certainly has been slowing, but where people can find not only the workers to produce the work, but where they can find customers for the products at prices that are competitive, there is a thriving industry, and it's that kind of industry in the United States that exists today and will continue, in fact, grow tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, no.
Yeah, Ms.
David,
I'd like to
jump in there.
Sure, yeah. Uh-huh.
And just to correct the record a little bit on what's happened in the steel industry. I mean, the steelmakers in the U.S. were not able to capitalize because there was a tremendous amount of steel that was dumped on the U.S. market in the late 70s and the 1980s. And even the free market Republican Ronald Reagan realized that and put some restrictions on imported steel. This happened again in the 1990s. The U.S. is the consumer market of last resort. We have the fewest trade restrictions, the lowest tariffs, the weakest trade regime of any industrialized country. And so when the Asian financial crisis and the financial crisis in Russia took root, the U.S. market again became the last vestige for world excess steel. It was dumped here. The prices were low. 40 steel companies went bankrupt. George Bush put in place some tariffs on this dumped steel, as he's entitled to do under our trade laws. Today, our steel companies are making investments in the U.S. United States Steel and ArcelorMittal Steel, which is based in Chicago and has operations in Northwest Indiana and around the country, each have pledged to invest $3 billion in capital improvements in their steel facilities, including some right around Pittsburgh, because today they're state-of-the-art. They can export steel, but they face some of these structural problems that we've been talking about, and I think that we need to focus on that. I think one of the real reasons that why we don't see a lot of capital investment in the U.S. is because a lot of multinational companies are choosing to invest in Asia. Intel, when it's building new fab and R&D facilities, is building in Shanghai rather than Colorado, and it's a trend that we're seeing across the board.
All right. Well, let's go to Chicago for another caller. This is line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm a little late to the show. I noticed you were talking about the automobile industry. One of the things I'd like to know is we just bailed them out for $25 billion. Now, is that part of the $700 billion bailout that Bush is talking about for Wall Street? And if we just spend all that money to bail out the automobile industry, why are they closing, General Motors, I believe it is, closing this plant in Janesville and putting all these people out of work?
Well, Mr. Goldstein, you got a response for that?
Well, the answer to the first part is the $25 billion for the auto industry is separate from the rescue plan that is up to $750 billion.
Well, I thought it was $700 billion.
Oh, well. I thought it was 750. In any event,
well, it's a lot of money, whatever it is.
It's a lot of money, and it's up to. It's not necessarily that we're going to spend that kind of money at the end of the day, and or get it back as we did 20 years ago with the Resolution Trust Corporation.
Well, now didn't we spend $200 billion in the 1980s to bail out the savings and loan industry?
Yeah, it was about. It ended up being about $150 billion. It was estimated to cost $60 billion when Congress passed it.
But we ended up spending $150 billion to bail them out. Isn't that what you're saying?
And the taxpayer got not only every penny back, but they actually made a little bit of a profit on the deal.
Well, don't look for that to happen this time, because I think the reason we're in this hole is because a lot of people on Wall Street got greedy.
David, I'd like to jump in here.
Yeah, sure. This is a slightly different subject, but if you want to talk about that, that's fine.
Sure. I think that going back to the auto loan guarantees, and I think this is a really good point, because it is, when Chrysler received some federal financing in the 1980s, it paid it back actually ahead of schedule with interest, and so there was no loss to the taxpayer. I think one of the challenges this time is that there has been such a dramatic downsizing already of the U.S. auto industry, this $25 billion loan guarantee, in a lot of ways, has been overtaken by other events. And if it's used to help retool some of these facilities to make more fuel-efficient cars, then perhaps a GM that has absorbed Chrysler, which is under discussion right now, and Ford, will be better positioned to compete.
How can they retool them if they're closing the plant down?
Well, I think that's very difficult. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of consolidation. I think there's going to be a lot of job loss. All of that is already underway. I think this is trying to look 10 years down the road, and I'm certainly not making an excuse for the car companies. I think that they miscalculated in a number of ways, but I do think that these loan guarantees, if they're put to use the right way, can help to preserve some jobs here and produce some automotive models. They're going to be attractive to consumers. They're going to be fuel efficient and are going to keep some jobs in the United States.
Well, I hope so. Like I said, they bailed out the savings and loan, and according to you, we got our money back. And I know this isn't the topic of the day, but I have trouble with this $700 billion bailout of Wall Street, I should tell you. I think before we do that, we should make these CEOs give up their golden parachutes and then talk about a bailout.
Well, before we move on, any last, Mr. Goldstein, you want to comment on any of this?
Well, look, you know, part of the reason why the United States is pouring so much money into the financial market and Europe pouring so much money into their financial market is precisely to unfreeze the credit market. Because an awful lot of these operations, I mean, if you think about it, you know, for example, if you take an automobile, actually a motor vehicle company that's producing trucks or buses, they're not going to get paid until they deliver those trucks, but they've got to pay the workers in order to produce them. And so, therefore, it's a credit business. If the credit markets are frozen, they can't get the money, they can't pay the workers, they can't get the trucks, they can't get paid. So what we're really trying to do here on both sides of the Atlantic is open up that frozen credit market to keep the economy from just simply grinding to a halt.
We're in a midpoint here, and I want to introduce quickly our two guests. Then we have other callers. We're talking this morning with Ken Goldstein and Scott Paul. Ken Goldstein is an economist at the Conference Board and has been working there since 1971. He's been, for the last three decades, been writing about the state of the economy in Conference Board publications and also gives many economic presentations to groups all around this country and Canada. Scott Paul is the founding executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, which was launched last April, that is April of 2007, of last year, particularly to do research and advocacy about domestic trade laws and, as they see it, the consequences of competition from other countries, China particularly. Before starting his group here, the Alliance for American Manufacturing, Scott Paul worked as the principal lobbyist for the Industrial Union Council. He was also a trade lobbyist at the AFL-CIO, where he led labor movements, legislative initiatives on international trade, manufacturing, and foreign policy issues. We drifted here a little bit in talking about the current economic crisis, and that's fine, but one of the things we really wanted to focus on this morning was the question of manufacturing in the U.S. economy and loss of manufacturing jobs and whether there was something we could do about that. So we want to continue to try to address those questions. And we have other folks here who'd like to be involved, too, in our conversation. So we'll continue to talk with callers. And the next person up is in Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to change from the heavy industry a little bit. Several years ago, we heard so much about jobs in service industries were going to be a major part of the U.S. economy. Many of those service industry jobs have already gone abroad. What's going to happen if they're recently talking about buying medical drugs abroad? It seems to me research is so important, and unless we're buying the medical drugs and supporting the local or the United States production, that we will really run into long-range problems and lose a lot of jobs. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. I appreciate the question. And this is something that I wanted to have us talk about maybe some more, that is the so-called switch to the service economy and what exactly that means. Is that a fair trade? You trade a manufacturing job for a service job. And are we also losing service jobs? Scott, do you want to?
Well, I think it's not a fair trade at all. Manufacturing jobs, as I mentioned before, support four or five other jobs in the community. Sometimes more than that. You don't get any that kind of a multiplier effect from a service sector job. Manufacturing jobs generally, their wages are 20% higher than the average wage in the United States. They have better health care benefits and. When a manufacturer leaves, and 40,000 factories have closed down over the last 10 years, they're generally the largest taxpayer in the local community. And whatever service jobs come in and whatever service providers come in don't make up that tax revenue. And it is not a trade-off that is helping the United States. I mean, you know, economic theory and those that talk about churning capitalism like to think that folks who are losing manufacturing jobs are going into better-paying jobs, but it's simply not the case. They end up one-third of the time never finding another job, and most of the people who do find another job end up in a job that pays far less than they did before. They'll end up as a greeter at Walmart. It is, if one thing has been shown by this financial crisis, I think it's the need to have people with the ability to pay their bills. Manufacturing helps to do that. And it shows the need to keep down our debt. And, you know, manufacturing and exporting from the United States helps to do that as well. And so if we squander the opportunity to revitalize our manufacturing base, we're going to dig ourselves a deeper hole in the decade to come.
Yeah, Mr. Goldstein, you want to add anything onto that?
Yeah, when we talk about jobs, we sort of have to focus on what we economists call value added, which is to say, how much value does that labor add to a specific service, to a specific product? Some jobs are lower value added, some jobs are higher value added. what's been going on, and again, it's not just the last decade, it's better than the last half century. In fact, I believe Joseph Schumpeter at one point taught at the University of Illinois. I might be wrong about that. But the Schumpeter argument was that, and he called it the destruction of capital, what he was talking about is losing a lower value job for a higher value added job. That's a process that's been going on at least minimum since the 1940s. That's where we are. That's what got us to an unemployment rate below 5% before we got into the current mess, and probably where we're headed, not just the next year, but for the next decade. And again, I come back to the point, whether it's a service job or a manufacturing job, and not all those out-of-work Wall Street types are going to be greeters at Walmart. But where we're really headed for is a check, if you will, on overall economic growth, because we can't find the people to do the jobs, rather than a situation that we're in at the moment of not being able to find jobs for all the people.
All right. We have other callers. Again, let's go next to the next caller. And I believe that would be somebody. They're actually out in the field working today. They're calling from their combine. We'll go there to line number one. Hello. Scholar there, line one.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Thanks both the guests for being on. It's very interesting. My question is, does it matter at all what the brand name is on the factory, Honda or Toyota versus Ford, GM, or Chrysler, whoever owns them anyway? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Is the question clear enough?
I think I get what he's saying. Is it, does it make a difference whether it's a foreign-owned company or a domestically owned company if perhaps the manufacturing is still occurring in the United States? That's how I interpret.
Well, either that or I suppose that, you never – it may have an American nameplate, but it may also have parts that are manufactured outside of the United States. So what does the nameplate mean anymore?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and there are a lot of iconic American brands that don't have any manufacturing in the United States anymore. But getting specifically to the point of the car companies, I mean, this is one of the things that the big three have been struggling with, is that the Japanese and the Korean makes that have set up transplants in the United States are having some success, and part of that is due to the models that they're putting out, but part of it is also to do that they don't face the structural health care cost situation that the big three does. And it makes a big difference, and they've increased their market share, and they've done it very well. At the end of the day, there are still American, there's still American steel going into those cars that are made at the transplants as well as at the big three factories. And so I think that for some people, the fact whether it's an American nameplate or a foreign nameplate is losing its relevance. And I think the caller prior to this actually made a very good point about prescription drugs. And if we lose our ability to make prescription drugs and are dependent upon foreign sources for that, when you look at the health and safety regimes in some of these countries, I think that's going to raise questions for a lot of people whether they're getting a safe product.
Hmm. Maybe let me, I want to turn to Mr. Goldstein and ask maybe a slightly different question, and that is, I think that today there are a lot of people when they go out to buy a product, no matter what it is, their big concern has to be price. And for that reason, do you think that people are either forced to, or maybe they just don't think very much about where something is made? And does the does the commitment to either buy something that's made in the United States, or if someone just says, "Well, I just don't care. I'm sorry, I got to go with the cheapest thing," does that really enter into what we're talking about?
Well, let's stick with the car customer as opposed to the car maker. Mm-hmm. I mean, he or she is going to go into a showroom. They're going to look for a style of a car, number one. They're going to look for what kind of mileage they're going to get from that car. Number three, they're going to look at the repair record. So cheaper doesn't necessarily mean cheaper sticker price, but cheaper to not only buy but to run that car, as well as, number four, what kind of deal they can get on the financing of it. And number five would be whether it's a Chrysler car with a whole bunch of Mitsubishi parts on it or a Toyota car made in Tennessee. So I think that we're kind of forced in a way. If we're looking for the sticker price, for the mileage, for the repair record, to sort of think about those things more than about whether, what the name brand on the car is. However, given all of that, given what we've seen from company after company, industry after industry, I think one of the things that companies right now are looking at is to burnish their brand. In other words, if they're the folks who can turn to their customers, new customers or existing customers, today or next year, and say, we were with you through this crisis, that perhaps they can get the kind of customer loyalty that will keep them in business and keep them in business in the United States, perhaps keep them in business in Illinois.
We're coming into about our last 15 minutes, and the lines are full here, and I want to try to get to some more folks, but we've spent a lot of time here talking about the problem and really not talking about what, if anything, we can do about it. And I want to at least give both of you the opportunity to talk for a couple of minutes about that. There are some things that we've touched on that are big issues, and we're not going to be able to solve the healthcare problem, or we have the energy issue. If we sort of put those aside, I'll stay with Mr. Goldstein here for a moment. Well, what do you think we can do about this? Is there something that we can do or things that we can do to try to get some of these jobs to come back to the United States?
Yeah, well, look at that caller who was asking about the drugs, the legal drugs that she needs or he might need for heart problems or other kinds of problems. As it happens, research into new drugs from companies like Hoffman La Roche and companies like Merck, I know these companies because I can virtually walk from my house to a Merck plant. Northern New Jersey and West Virginia happen to be two of the big areas, not just for drug manufacture, but for drug research. And it's that research into the new products, into the kinds of things that we're going to be producing tomorrow. Let's just step back again. I keep trying to do this. We have in the United States something called the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. Half of the titles, in other words, the name or the type of description of the job you or I do, half of the jobs today did not exist 50, 40 years ago. And perhaps as much as 20, 30% of the jobs that the kids who are in high school in Chicago today are going to be working in 2020 or 2030 don't even exist today. I mean, when I got out of school, I couldn't think about getting a job to go play a video game, get paid to do that kind of a job. The kind of research, the kind of support for that research, the kind of support for the financing, not only the jobs here now, but the jobs we can think of, we can dream of, we can create over the next decade, over the next two decades, those are the jobs that those kids are going to be working in then. And I think what we need to do is look at the research, look at the support, look at the financing, and look at the education to make sure that those kids have the skills to do those kinds of jobs tomorrow. I would think whatever the solution is, it's got to include some of those aspects to it.
Mr. Paul, you want to add on to that?
Yeah, I think that I'd take a little bit of a broader view, and I do think that we need to maintain a strong manufacturing base for our economic security, for opportunities for the next generation, and for our national security as well. And so I don't think that we need to focus on other areas exclusive of manufacturing. Now, to make manufacturing more competitive, there are a couple of things that we can do because we have policies in place that make it hard to keep and grow manufacturing jobs in this country. First is our trade policy. We allow China to subsidize its industries in violation of trade rules, to manipulate its currency in violation of trade rules, to have lax environmental standards that our own manufacturers don't have to meet. When you add these up, the wage difference between the United States and China doesn't matter in a lot of these high-value industries. But you need to have a strong trade enforcement regime to make sure that there's truly a level playing field, because We have highly skilled workers. We have productive factories. Many of them have adopted a lean method, and they're very efficient, and they can be competitive against anyone in the world if we really have a level playing field. So that's first on trade. Second, we need to reform the healthcare system. We have one of the only healthcare systems in the world where the burden is placed squarely on the shoulders of manufacturers who are providing healthcare. And it's not a system that's in place in China or Japan or Mexico or Brazil or Germany or any of our other competition. In fact, we end up financing their healthcare system when we buy imports because of the VAT tax system that they have in place. We also need to be smart about investments. If we are to invest in infrastructure, it's a win-win for manufacturing because there are manufactured materials that go into building infrastructure. At the same time, having an improved infrastructure makes our delivery systems more efficient. So there are a number of simple things that we can do, and healthcare reform is not simple, but it's straightforward, that we can do to help have a vibrant and growing manufacturing base in the future. And these are policy choices and not any sort of an economic situation that we're not able to control.
Okay. We have a number of callers here. We have about 10 minutes left, and we'll try to get as many as we can. And we'll go next to someone on a cell phone on our line number 2 here. Hello.
Yes. Two questions. Have your guests talk about the imperialistic nature of capitalism and banking, which is the new paradigm that evolved over the last 500 to 700 years, and how that has wreaked havoc upon the population that we see today. The imperialization process and a level playing field are inconceivable. Thank you, and I'll listen on the radio.
No? Okay. Mr. Goldstein, can you take that on?
Well, what our finance is, in fact, if you go back to that old Jimmy Stewart movie where he's standing in the middle of the bank while the customers are running in saying, you know, where's my money? And he's trying to reassure them. If you go back to that, go out and rent that movie tonight, even though what we do today is more technologically innovative, but essentially what we're trying to do, even what the Federal Reserve is trying to do, in a sense, is what Jimmy Stewart was trying to do standing in that bank. Those folks with an idea about how to take money and make money, they can usually find a finance, either going to a bank, going to the capital market, going to the commercial paper market, whether here or in Europe or in Asia, if it really is a good idea, if it really does show promise, you can probably find somebody who's willing to put some money up to see if it'll work.
Well, let's go on to another caller. We'll go to line number 1, and this is somebody in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes?
Two ideas, please, to keep things brief. Why don't we quit as a nation, quit being so passive about imports and just tax the hell out of things to the point where it would be more cost-effective and competitive to build and sell and so forth in this country. But with the basic idea being, if you're going to sell it here, you better make it here with American labor, using American raw materials, and so on and so forth, and under American labor laws and things like that. And also, wouldn't it help? I think this would help anyway. My personal experience in industry over many a year would be the resurgence of organized labor and actually making it almost mandatory for any operation, any business of X number of employees or bigger must have collective bargaining, which to my way of thinking is the best way to rein in some of the outrageous wages that the people at the top get and the people like me at the bottom don't get. So if you would comment on that, please. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Paul, I expect you would certainly agree with the second point.
Well, I think that it has been shown that a unionized workforce is highly skilled, is stable, and can contribute to the bottom line of a company. And more labor agreements today are including productivity bonuses and profit sharing. And so there's an invested stake in it. And I think that certainly if you're going to grow wages, which is going to produce wealth for the middle income folks in this country, having a more robust labor movement and having sensible labor laws to allow that is a sensible path forward. On the trade question, I think that, you know, trade can and should benefit consumers, businesses, and workers in the United States. Trade, if it's done correctly, if we have the right rules, is a very, very good thing. And we can compete against any country, especially when it comes to high-value manufactured products. But what we don't have is a level playing field. And I don't even expect foreign countries to have U.S. minimum wages to be able to get access to our market. I just expect them to offer us equal access as we offer them, and we often don't get that, even when we do free trade agreements. We have poorly negotiated trade agreements. We have poorly enforced trade agreements. One of the results is that we have a $700 billion trade deficit last year that's financed by China. And it is not a sustainable path. Folks like Warren Buffett have warned against this sort of thing. So this isn't just the labor movement that thinks that this is a problem, having such a steep current account deficit. And we need to take some action. It should be a priority of the next president and the next Congress.
Could I jump in?
Yes, please do. Yes.
Yeah, because my old professor at Rutgers University, Leo Troy, would probably turn over in his grave if I didn't defend organized labor and collective bargaining, and so I will. But the other point I would quickly make is we could put up a wall around the United States, but if we did that, what's to stop anybody else from putting a wall up against us? That really is a less than zero-sum game. We shouldn't go there.
Well, I guess then the question is, what sort of leverage does the U.S. government have in working with a country like China, for example, to try to, if the playing field is not level, well, what sort of leverage do we have to try to persuade them that if they're placing restrictions on imports, or if they're providing subsidies to their own producers, and it's not just the Chinese to do this, a lot of people do it, we do it, what sort of leverage do we have to persuade them to do otherwise?
Actually, I think it's a very good question in the sense that the first thing anybody has to do looking across the bargaining table is to understand the other side and where they're coming from. Otherwise, you know, we're just going to wind up yelling at each other and get nowhere. The first thing we have to understand about the Chinese, and by extension others, is what's their main concern. Their main concern, in some sense, is the same as ours: growing enough jobs to take care of their population. That's one of the major concerns here. It's one of the major concerns certainly in China. Then once we understand where each other are coming from, then perhaps we can, you know, bargain across the table more as equals and see if we can come up with some common ground that benefits both of us. If we can't find that common ground, we're going to go nowhere. If we can find that common ground, we can both grow.
We have about a minute or two left. I want to try to squeeze in at least one call, and this is the next person in line, and that's line 3. Hello.
Yeah, the issue is quality control. When we had American manufacturing, the quality got better and better, except for the car industry. But brand names like GE, things are, you know, for consumer brands, are now made in China. It seems like every time I buy something, I got to bring it back, you know, because of quality control. So would you like to comment on that?
Well,
I'd love to comment on that, if I could.
Yeah,
and
go ahead.
One thing I would say is that this has even made its way into popular culture. At the Batman movie this summer, there was a misfiring gun that was made in China, and the DA, Harvey Dent, said, next time buy American, and this thing will shoot. But it's a very good point. I mean, the challenge that folks like GM faced is that they are now making quality products, and this is according to consumer surveys and other folks, but their name brand is so tarnished that they have a big hole to climb out of. There are steel companies that have the most competitive factories in the entire world here. So American manufacturing can make safe products, can make quality products, but they don't play on that level playing field that we've been talking about, and that's the biggest challenge that they face.
One last point, and let me ask Ken Goldstein. Some of the articles I've read recently suggest that maybe this is starting to turn around a little bit, that American manufacturers are thinking again about bringing jobs back in part because of high energy costs and the cost involved in shipping something that you've made outside of the U.S. back to the United States. Do you see some hope on this?
Well, it's not just high energy costs. It's also, you know, sending all these jobs abroad lengthens out the supply chain, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, it could lead to more problems. And we certainly saw that just about a month or two ago with the strike up in the Pacific Northwest. So that, you know, I mean, these competitive forces have forced change. They will continue to force change and continue to force us to look to be more competitive as well as to be more efficient in order to stay in business.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Ken Goldstein. He is an economist with the Conference Board. Mr. Goldstein, thank you very much.
And our better days are still ahead.
Let's hope so. And our guest, Scott Paul, he is the Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Mr. Paul, thank you very much.
David, thanks again. And I do hope that it is darkest before the dawn.